Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, I'm Justin Brierley, and welcome back to The Unbelievable Show, the place where we bring you conversations that matter every week. And today, it's the broadcast of our recent live stream with Kristin Cobez-Dumais, whose book Jesus and John Wayne has been a runaway success. We're going to be talking about evangelicalism, masculinity, Donald Trump, and Mark Driscoll on the show today, and hearing what questions viewers asked of Kristin during the live stream. Now, if you want to make sure you don't miss out on chances for things like live streams and bonus content from the show, do make sure you're subscribed to our newsletter. You can do that by visiting our show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You'll also find the links with today's show if you're listening via podcast. Also, more resources and ways to support the show as well there. And links, of course, to today's guest, Kristin. Later on in the show, I'm going to be announcing some new event dates, exciting news from Genexis. They're going to be in Coventry and London in September. Our friends at Genexis will be bringing some fantastic speakers and topics to both venues in September. So look out for that a little later on today's show. Also, exciting news that in September, we'll be releasing our very own online apologetics course from Unbelievable. Now, those who attended the Unbelievable conference back in May had early exclusive access to this, but we'll be making it available to everyone soon. So look out for details of that on a future show in September. And of course, later on today, we'll be hearing your feedback. Lovely to receive actually just this yesterday from Alistair in Australia, who said, "Justin, I wanted to thank you for your work on the Unbelievable show. You set an excellent example for respectful and productive conversation between varying worldviews, something so important to promote in our polarized society with self-reinforcing social media bubbles, etc. I admire your high level of impartiality, which gives guests a fair opportunity to express themselves and assist listeners with informed consideration. I think this is key to your long-term engagement with both guests and listeners. As an atheist, I've found your content to be highly interesting and an effective tool for deliberately scrutinizing my own beliefs and challenging my own biases. Keep up the awesome work." Alistair in Australia, thank you so much. That means so much, actually, to receive that kind of a message into the show. We'll be hearing more of your feedback later on the programme. Right now, time to get into this week's conversation, one-to-one conversation, with Kristin Cobez-Dumais.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome along, Kristin, to the show. It's great to have you here. So many people have been saying, when are you going to get Kristin Cobez-Dumais on your show, Justin? I'm glad we've been able to make it happen, finally. So welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
How's life in Michigan at the moment?
Life is, you know, we just keep managing. It's very hot and humid here right now. Kids are just back in school this week, which is great, but also, you know, lots of new school activities, and our semester starts up on Tuesday, so things are picking up. Oh, and then COVID. We have COVID all over.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
So that too.
Well, you've had quite the year, not just for those normal reasons that everyone's experienced, but because of this extraordinary book, which has been a runaway bestseller, Kristin, Jesus and John Wayne. Before we launch into the actual material of the book, were you expecting the kind of response it's had? Because I think it's almost grown over the last year, really, that response, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and up through like October, November, it was considered a really successful book. And when I would get asked this, I was like, yeah, I actually kind of thought it was a big book. I thought it really spoke to the moment. I thought it would find its readers. I have a great publisher, and I was pretty confident. You know, we had a nice premiere on debut on NPR. And so, yeah, things were kind of going as planned. What I didn't expect was for the momentum to just continue and increase, and particularly for its popularity with white evangelicals themselves. That's something I didn't anticipate, not to this extent.
Given that, in a sense, it's the white evangelicals who come in for some criticism, I understand what you're saying. But in a sense, I suppose that's heartening, that there's obviously a significant audience that wants to understand what's happening in this cultural moment, and obviously some of the criticisms that you have in the book about it. But when it comes to the reason it's had this momentum, what I mean, even with, you know, in a sense, Trump now somewhat in the back mirror, why has it continued to grow in that way, would you say, Kristen?
Yeah, well, you know, the book isn't really written with white evangelicals as its primary audience. The subtitle is a bit of a clue there. And, you know, it's not a book that's meant to woo evangelicals. And so, you know, I think its initial audience was primarily just the national audience. And then it took a little time, I think, for a lot of evangelicals to realize, oh, we can read this book. this book is for us too. And it started to kind of make its way through evangelical spaces, first through word of mouth and through this podcast network. So, you know, small podcasts, often conservative white men who said, hey, you know, there's truth here. We need to talk about this. So it started this almost not quite underground movement, but kind of grassroots. And then some bigger names started talking about it. When Beth Moore tweeted about it, I think that really gave a lot of people permission to say, oh, this is for us. And and we do need to engage this. And then there's just the larger political backdrop, right, where we had the 2020 election, and then it was contested and it never seemed to end. And then we had the events of January 6th. And, you know, those events, the storming the Capitol and violence that we saw, the Christian imagery, I think it just really confronted people, the enormity of the situation. And this is a book that speaks to all of those things. And also it's a book that, because it's a book about popular culture, it was a book that I think connected with ordinary evangelicals very intimately. So I get a ton of letters every day, and most of them start with some version of, this is the story of my life. And so I think it just connects intimately with readers.
That's so interesting. Well, look, we're going to be talking about, obviously, the book, the thesis, evangelicalism. I think we should define that as well as part of this. Obviously, politics, Trump, and so on will all feature in the conversation. But recently, there's been a really interesting sort of podcast that's blown up and been in all of our social media feeds, the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. And we'll talk about that and Mark Driscoll and how that perhaps feeds into some of the what you're talking about in the book as well. But just before we get to all that, let's get to know you a little, Kristen. So you teach history at Calvin University. Calvin, is that a primarily Christian university there in Grand Rapids?
It is. Named after John Calvin, Dutch Reformed tradition. I'd say the majority of our students are white evangelicals. So, yes.
And I mean, in that sense, you yourself are a Christian, Kristen. Have you ever worn that label, evangelical, or is that one you've tended to steer clear of yourself?
So I've never really identified as an evangelical. I grew up in this Dutch Reformed subculture in a small town in Iowa. My dad was a ordained minister, theology professor, wrote his dissertation on Abraham Kuyper, if that means anything to you or your listeners. So, you know, in a subculture. And we didn't define ourselves as evangelicals. We defined ourselves over against American evangelicals, right? We were distinctive and we were a lot smarter than evangelicals were. That's what I kind of grew up assuming. And I didn't personally identify as evangelical. That said, my denomination that I belong to, the Christian Reformed Church, is part of the National Association of Evangelicals. And I did grow up very much enmeshed in evangelical popular culture. So I only listened to Christian music, shopped at a Christian bookstore. And so that popular culture that I give a lot of attention to here was very much a part of my upbringing.
Yeah, it's something that I think is often helpful with these sorts of things. When we talk about evangelical, that can mean different things to different people,
yes,
can't it? So how do you define it in the book? What do you mean by evangelical. Some people will have a very theological label for that. Others will have a very cultural label for that. Where do you find yourself on that?
Yeah, I'm a cultural historian, so I'm definitely more on the cultural side. And I didn't actually intend when I started writing this book, I wasn't going to redefine evangelicalism. I had no interest in that. My plan was just to drop in the standard definition of evangelicalism that scholars always use, which is a theological one. And so essentially defines evangelicals according to their theological beliefs, things like crucicentrism, the centrality of the cross, biblicism, the authority of the scriptures, conversionism, this born-again experience, and then evangelism or activism. And if you check those boxes, you're an evangelical. But as I was writing this book, I just kept running up against that and realizing this doesn't capture what I'm actually describing. And so I came to see evangelicalism in U.S. history, particularly the last half century, 70 years or so, as more of a cultural movement, and less of a kind of theological rubric. And that's why I really emphasize this popular culture. It's not, are you a real evangelical or not, by, you know, can you check all these boxes? In fact, the majority of people who self-identify as evangelicals aren't very theologically literate. In fact, many of them hold beliefs that could be counted as heresy. So, you know, theology just isn't at the center of what it means to be an evangelical. So instead, I talk about evangelicalism as a series of networks and alliances and as a consumer culture. How deeply are you enmeshed in that? Maybe you just dabble in it a little bit. Maybe you're all in. And that's how I treat evangelicalism. And so this book is really mapping that out, mapping out these alliances, describing these distribution networks, the cultural products, and then examining that kind of evangelicalism and where that takes us.
So having defined evangelical, as you use it in the book, at least, the book begins with Trump, and indeed it came out obviously shortly before, you know, the election, obviously, which he lost ultimately.
Yes.
But you say that Trump isn't sort of some anomaly, and the fact that, I don't know, what was it at the last election? Something like 75% of white evangelicals cast their vote in his favor. That is not an anomaly, just an accident of history. Give us the sort of the background to what you felt, you know, led up to this and what it's significant about it.
Yeah. So, you know, around 2016, the big question was, you know, would white evangelicals support Trump? And then when that answer became clear, the next big question was, how could they? How could white evangelicals betray their values and vote for a man like Donald Trump, who seemed to stand against all of their values that they held most dear, right? Family values, evangelicals, the moral majority. And what I knew at that point, because I had already spent quite some time examining evangelical views of masculinity, particularly of this warrior masculinity, I knew that people were asking this question didn't fully understand what evangelical values actually were and what was at the heart of family values evangelicalism. Historically, I knew that we had to place the assertion of white patriarchal authority at the heart of family values evangelicalism. And that's a vision of masculine leadership, of masculine heroism that champions doing what needs to be done, champions, whatever the cost, violence to achieve righteousness. And once you locate that kind of at the heart of the evangelical value system, then somebody like Trump makes an awful lot of sense. And this really came to me, by the way, I had 15 years ago already started researching evangelical masculinity and how it was intertwined with militarism. And then I ended up setting that project aside, always meaning to come back to it. And it was in the days after the release of the Access Hollywood tape in October of 2016, when we saw evangelicals, briefly waver in their support of Trump when we had this, you know, him on video bragging about assaulting women. And then within the week, they were all back supporting him. And that's when it clicked for me that, you know, we've seen this before. We've seen this so many times before. And if we had been properly listening to the rhetoric around evangelical manhood and heroism and really ruthlessness and understanding this militancy at the heart of evangelicalism, then this just shouldn't come as a surprise at all. Mm-hmm. At all.
I mean, just sticking with Trump for a minute, though obviously the book is about far more than just Trump. A lot of British evangelicals on this side of the pond were very confused, concerned when, you know, there was this outpouring of support for Trump. Mm-hmm. But then as I spoke to a lot of my friends and colleagues in the US who had voted Trump, a lot of them at the time, this is, you know, back in 2016, said, well, he was, you know, the better of two bad alternatives. Yes. And so on. So this was frequently the reason given, you know. Yes. And that obviously, you know, the Democrat Party, Clinton in particular, and latterly Biden, you know, stood for all kinds of things that they couldn't possibly sanction around mm-hmm. abortion, and LGBT, and, you know, issues around the family and so on. And that was the reason why. And yes, Trump was, in a sense, a strong character. But Lorden said, well, maybe we need a strong character at this time, even if you don't like his manners. You know, we're going to hold our nose and we're going to vote for the guy who is instituting what obviously they believe are Christian, mm-hmm. you know, policies in the country, or more likely to, at least. So what's your response to that? Because mm-hmm. people aren't going to say, no, we weren't looking for a bully or a strong man. We were looking for someone who would represent us at the ballot box. And a lot of them would say, well, that's what he did in the 4 years he was there as well.
Yeah, well, you know, first, some absolutely said we're looking for a bully, except they wouldn't use quite that terminology. They, you know, he's our ultimate fighting champion. He's going to protect us. And he's God's anointed, who was given to us precisely because he is so ruthless, and he will be ruthless on our behalf. So there was a lot of that rhetoric, actually, in 2016 and continuing. But also, I would suggest that we need to look more closely at evangelical support during the primary season, that if white evangelicals had not supported Trump throughout the primaries, he would not have been the nominee, right? And that isn't to say that the majority of evangelicals supported him, but we had a whole slew of candidates, right? But early on, already in 2015, you were seeing, not at the leadership, not top down, it took a while for them to get on board, but this grassroots support. Already in, I think, August of 2015, we saw those numbers and it was getting media attention. And so white evangelicals were choosing him above the other slate of candidates. And that only increased with time. The more they got to know him, the more he appeared on that primary stage, the more he was, making himself known. And he was like unlike any candidate we'd ever seen before. You know, he was just absolutely unrestrained and completely broke all the rules. And the more he did that, the more evangelicals came to back him. So yes, the narrative was Hillary Clinton. You know, we couldn't possibly vote for Hillary Clinton. You have to hold your nose and vote for Trump. And that is absolutely true for some people. But their enthusiasm for Trump did not wane once Hillary Clinton was safely defeated, right? And that's where you can see the survey data throughout his 4 years as president continued to be, white evangelicals, his stalwart supporters, far and above the, you know, support of any other demographic, through thick and thin, didn't matter what happened. And so this whole nose-holding theory doesn't hold a lot of water. And then there's the fact that, okay, policy-wise, again, any Republican candidate would be, you know, standing for those same policies. And Trump is the one that they wanted. When they had a chance to impeach him and, you know, get Pence, one who is truly one of their own, there was absolutely no desire to have Mike Pence in that role. They wanted Trump.
So where did this desire, as you see it, for this strong kind of almost, you know, bullying kind of approach come from? And just, again, it'll still have to be the really, you know, boiled down version of this, Christine, because of time. But where does that culture come from? Where did you trace it back to historically?
Well, I really emphasize the significance of the Cold War era, when this kind of militant faith made a lot of sense in the Cold War context. Communists were anti-God, they were anti-family, they were anti-American, and they were an active military threat. So they needed a strong military defense. And this is where, you know, Christian nationalism really comes to the fore as well. This idea that America is a Christian nation and it has to be defended as such, defended militarily, and the centrality of Christianity has to be defended against domestic enemies as well. And so that's really the strand that I pull through. And this is a kind of militant faith where it thrives on the relationship between militancy and fear. when I started off this project, I thought that militancy was really a response to fear. All right, they're afraid of communists. They're afraid of, you know, fill in the blank, and therefore we see this militancy. What my research showed me is we need to flip that script. More often than not, it was the militancy that came first, and you see leaders, pastors, political leaders actively stoke fear in the hearts of their followers in order to consolidate their own power. So the militancy often came before the fear.
That's really interesting. In terms of the sort of where that's brought us to, as it were, now, I mean, when you go to the average American, I mean, there are outliers, obviously, but the average American megachurch, evangelical megachurch, what you'll find there is something very welcoming, not something threatening or militaristic, normally, at least. So how does this play out? I mean, is it more at the kind of the subculture level, the kind of area of politics and power and that kind of thing, rather than what you get maybe on a Sunday in a sort of, I don't know, Joel Osteen's, you know, church in Houston or wherever?
Yeah, what I would say is you'll actually get a mix. You'll get a mix at many churches because, you know, you walk in the doors, you will absolutely be welcomed because that's evangelism, right? Come join us. Come be one of us. Come share our values, right? Now, the reception could change a little bit if you start to challenge some of those values, if you start to say, well, what about this or what about that? But you're going to absolutely encounter this friendly reception. You're going to hear a lot of praise music, right? It's going to seem like quite, you know, light and fluffy and welcoming and warm. And at the same time, you know, take a look at what the men's ministry is up to. And why do they have a separate men's ministry and a separate women's ministry? And look at this kind of gender breakdown and what sorts of values are they promulgating? And in the men's ministry, you're likely going to get some of this kind of rhetoric. Extremely popular, millions of copies of the books that I write about that are advancing this militant Christian manhood have been sold, have been read, have been studied together as the Word of God. So this culture really does permeate American evangelicalism. And it's not that you have this kind and gentle version or this more militant version. This militant version is cloaked with this kindness and this sweetness and this evangelism, but then scratched beneath the surface, and you're going to find this political agenda, and you're going to find these values in many mainstream evangelical churches.
There's obviously something attractive about that, though, for a number of people. I mean, and obviously, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is the rise and fall of Mars Hill, this podcast from Christianity Today, which Mike Cosper has done an amazing job at hosting and producing. I've been glued to it whenever it's come out. And you've featured on several of the episodes yourself, Kristin. But there, you know, it's telling the story of Pastor Mark Driscoll, who, you know, back in the 2000s was on everyone's timeline as well. And for those who aren't familiar, founding pastor, or one of the founding pastors of Mars Hill, a mega church in Seattle, rose to great heights of popularity, but was increasingly criticized for his brash, some would say authoritarian, bullying style, resigned from the church in 2014. And the church itself closed down shortly afterwards, which perhaps suggests how dependent they were on Mark himself, on the platform. I've got some of my own stories to tell of Mark Driscoll, actually, which maybe we'll come to later. But obviously, he drew a massive crowd and was incredibly phenomenally popular on, you know, podcast and video and everything else. So a lot of people do rally to that very sort of strong, masculine form of Christianity. What's the attraction? Why is it so popular then, Kristin?
Yeah. You know, I talked to a lot of men who had fallen under the sway of pastors like Mark Driscoll and John Piper and others. And, you know, I heard a variety of different stories, but many men really liked being told that they were powerful, that they could be powerful. And these weren't men who were like power hungry. You know, often these were like younger men, teenagers, 20 somethings who didn't really have their life together maybe, or felt like there was something more out there. And then they were told, you are a leader. All you need to do is step up and accept that leadership role. You are called to be strong. You are called to be courageous. Like, there's some good stuff there, right? Now it becomes a little bit more, suspect when it is highly gendered, because women also kind of like to have a purpose. Women like to be called to step up and be courageous and be strong. But, you know, in this whole system, women were not called to that. Women were called to step back. Women were called to be the beauty to be rescued, to be the passive, you know, sidekick of the hero in the story, who is the man. But I think for many men, it provided a sense of purpose. And then the community also, for people who were directly under his leadership in Mars Hill. Some are coming from unchurched backgrounds. They didn't know that this wasn't, you know, business as usual. Others were coming from different spaces, but Mark looked really cool. He looked really hip. And, you know, he provided community, but then had very strict rules for staying in that community. And all of this was preached in terms of God's will and in terms of ultimate truth. And anything outside of that closed space was of the enemy. Even the church down the road, you go there, your theology could become wrong and you could be damned for all eternity, right? And so the stakes were so incredibly high. It was great to be a part of that in some ways, but it was also, there was so much pressure to stay absolutely loyal.
I want to come to a question actually on masculinity from someone, and I just want to remind anyone watching that if you'd like to ask a question, this is your opportunity. From here on in, we'll be asking as many questions as we can of Kristin. You can do that by leaving a question in the comment wherever you're watching, on Facebook or YouTube. Just for those who aren't familiar with the book, Kristin, could you show us the cover of the book?
Sure.
I know you've got one to hand. There you are. Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. Now, welcome to ask the tough questions of Kristin. I'm sure there are many people watching who maybe don't agree with every aspect of Kristin's perspective on this, but we'd be happy to hear from you, whatever your thoughts are. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, here on Premier Christian Radio and via podcast, broadcasting our recent live stream with Kristin Cobez-Dumais. We'll be returning with your questions in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's Unbelievable. Kristin Cobez-Dumais joined me for a live stream Q&A this past week, and we took your questions too. Grace wants to know, I'm curious, Kristin, what positive aspects of masculinity did you see in your research, if any? So what should evangelicals keep?
First, let me say that there are many different evangelical masculinities at play. In fact, my first draft of the proposal for this book, I had wanted to include an entire chapter on alternative evangelical masculinities and how this played out, both in terms of race and in terms of, you know, more of the servant leadership variety and so on. What I ended up, that got cut at the editorial stage, saying that's great for an academic book. This is a trade book. Just pull one thread all the way through. This particular more militant conception of masculinity, again, I think it does give people who might, lack direction, a challenge to step up, to be responsible, to kind of take charge of their lives. I think often, again, kind of 20-something young men in this society where it can be hard to find secure employment, where there's this kind of prolonged adolescent phase, it can be good to be told to step up and accept responsibility. But I actually have a very hard time identifying good things that don't have a shadow side that outweighs the good. Because as soon as you're saying this is just for men, and then it warps some of these good things. Why is it that this is just, if men are the ones who are called to lead, where does that leave women? And what does that justify in terms of, you know, behaviors and so on that can be condoned because they're called to lead? So I do have a hard time finding really good things that I don't have to immediately say, but there's a darker side. When you impose the stark gender difference where masculine and feminine are perceived to be opposites, absolute opposite. So then the good that is given to like masculinity is taken from women in the same spaces.
I mean, there has been this phrase, hasn't there? Toxic masculinity has been a phrase, you know, used a lot in the last few years. And unfortunately, it's become one of those rather loaded terms because, you know, some people roll their eyes as soon as they hear it and say, oh, no, here's another wokeism. Others think there is a genuine problem with, you know, toxic masculinity. What for you is, I don't know, is there a biblical, if you like, form of masculinity that is modeled in scripture that you would say, no, if you're looking to be quote unquote masculine, then this is the model you should be approaching rather than that, I don't know, the Mark Driscoll version or whatever it might be.
Yeah. So interesting that you say that. I don't use the phrase toxic masculinity anywhere in the book, by the way. That was a very intentional choice because it means things to certain people and it's completely alienating to others. I thought it was kind of a lazy move. So I didn't go there. But is there a biblical masculinity? Who should men look to? I mean, the Bible is really complicated, right? I mean, pick a guy in the Bible apart from Jesus, and it's going to be a flawed model. So I tend to want to step back from that question because I think that question has been, in some ways, that question reflects this history that I've traced, that there has to be a biblical manhood, a Christian masculinity that is held up for all men to pattern their lives after, instead of thinking more broadly, what does it mean for each individual person, men and women, to follow Christ? Because God has created people with so much diversity in all sorts of ways, both in terms of gender, but really everything, giftedness, personalities. I mean, there's just so much diversity in creation. And we are all given one model, really. We are all called to follow Jesus Christ, women and men to follow Jesus Christ. So I think we should be asking much more, what does it mean for each of us as we are created, as we are made, as we find ourselves to pattern our lives after Jesus Christ? And that might look different for, you know, there's not one model that we aspire to. There's not, you know, you gotta be able to climb a rock wall and shoot, you know, venison and, you know, and then, you know, you check those boxes, you're good. That's just so artificial. It's so culturally positioned and it really doesn't fit most men.
I mean, just sticking with masculinity, few people seem to be want to sort of get more thoughts on this. Callum says, there's been a few episodes on Unbelievable talking about a crisis of masculinity in the past. How much do you think there has been this so-called crisis of masculinity, Kristin? What's your thoughts on that?
I love this question. Historians love this question because historians can point you to many, many periods in time where a crisis of masculinity was suddenly discovered, right? So then we are trained to ask particular questions. First of all, it's important to realize that masculinity is connected to economic shifts. Masculinity is connected to things like foreign policy. Masculinity is race specific. It's class specific. And so what we do then is we look at when people start talking about or inventing a crisis of masculinity in any particular moment, we start to look at, okay, what's changing here? Why did the old patterns that were largely agreed upon, not perfectly agreed upon, but the dominant ideas of manhood, why do those stop working in a certain moment? And why do they suddenly need to be renegotiated? That's the crisis. And so rather than seeing like everything's great, everything's static, and all of a sudden crisis moment, history is all about constant change over time. So the crisis of masculinity right now, we could point to a number of different things. If we look at, you know, race-specific causes among white people, there's often a sense of feeling a kind of moment of racial threat or racial decline and then needing to assert white manhood or white Christian manhood in response. That can be part of it. Economics are really important here. As the economy is changing, as the breadwinner economy, particularly in the 1970s, 1980s, started to give way, which, by the way, in and of itself was a relatively recent development, this breadwinner masculinity, right? But when that started to become less tenable, we see this crisis of masculinity when the nature of work changes from working with your hands and producing to being more middle management. Am I even a man anymore, right? All of these things are going to make people feel like there is a crisis because things are changing.
I've got another question here also on the masculinity thing. This is an interesting, quite specific one, and might maybe need some explanation for those who haven't heard of this movement, especially on this side of the pond. Peter says, I was quite surprised by the antipathy that some evangelicals such as Mark Driscoll had towards promise keepers. Yes. How widespread was that? So just to explain what promise keepers is and how it links into this whole discussion on masculinity here.
Yeah, promise keepers was a really big movement, the evangelical men's movement in the 1990s. It was headed up by Bill McCartney, and he was a football coach, and he decided that there was a crisis in American masculinity and American Christian masculinity, and he was going to solve that. He called thousands of men together to gather together in stadiums and to keep their promises, to lead their families, to take on that role of servant leadership. And so at the time in the 90s, like, you know, feminists would look at this and many liberals, progressives, like, this is terrible. This is, you know, the religious right radicalized. And in fact, it was more moderate than what had come before and certainly than what would come after. It was this kind of soft patriarchy. So yes, you need to lead, but you need to be nice about it. And this kinder, gentler model, tenderness. And so this is where we have the tender warrior motif. This is where men would come together and be told, you know, you can be emotional. You should hug each other. This is a new way to be a Christian man. And that was great until it wasn't. By the late 1990s, there's this growing backlash against that. Things had gotten a little too soft, a little too tender. And so you see the pendulum swing back towards a more aggressive, muscular Christianity. And so you see books come out like John Eldredge's Wild at Heart, James Dobson's Bring It Boys. That's all about testosterone is the key to masculinity. God is a warrior God and men are made in his image. Every man is a battle to fight. And then 9/11 happens, 2001. All these books are newly on the shelves, and this vision of a real militant masculinity resonates across American evangelicalism and beyond. So that older model of promise keepers just feels, in their mind, toxic, right? It's just way too soft. Things had gone way too far, way too effeminate, even though they were still upholding patriarchy. And we need to regain. And so Promise Keepers rebrands in the early 2000s, Not Your Daddy's PK. All right, we're going to storm the gates. And they have all this militaristic imagery. And that's kind of this, again, change over time that we see.
Right. It's really interesting to see the way that these things have sort of developed over the years. Obviously, the story of Mark Driscoll is also the story of effectively the fall of a pastor. Now, not perhaps for all the typical reasons, sadly, in a way that right. pastors are often falling, right. which frequently do involve issues, you know, sexual misdemeanors and abuse in congregations and that sort of thing. But why? I mean, it feels like everything's come together in the last few years. You've had, obviously, a very political dimension to a lot of evangelicalism in the US. Plus, you've had all these very high profile falls of significant ministries and pastors in them. How are these linked? What's your diagnosis, if you like, for all of that, Christine?
Yeah. So when I first started paying attention to this topic in the early 2000s, I started looking at people like Driscoll, and he just seems so extreme. And so I had this question, you know, what's fringe here and what's actually, you know, mainstream, and is this even worth my attention? And yes, he sold people like John Eldredge sold 4 million copies of his Wild at Heart, but still it feels kind of fringe. You know, how do I tease this out? So I ended up setting the project aside for a long time. But I didn't stop paying attention to all of these proponents of militant masculinity. And what I saw in the ensuing decade was one after another of these guys become embroiled in abuse abuse situations, abuse of power, sexual abuse, either directly as perpetrators or indirectly supporting their friends who were perpetrators. And so I just had my eye on this for a very long time. And I knew when I decided to write this book in the fall of 2016, I knew this needed to be a part of the story. I knew it needed to be a chapter in the book. In fact, one of the first things I did was consult a lawyer, because this was pre-Me Too when I started working on this book. And so the stories were largely living on blogs and survivor testimonies, and they weren't yet, they hadn't yet kind of hit the mainstream media. But I knew this needed to be a part of the story, because I saw how time and again, this abusive leadership was justified and protected by these evangelical communities, that they would, when stories came to light, almost every single case that I looked at, the community would end up defending the perpetrator, the pastor, the leader, and blaming the victim, and just further traumatizing the victims. And this was such a repeated pattern. I came to see how evangelical teachings, not just on masculinity and this kind of militant leadership style, testosterone, boys will be boys kind of thing, but also teachings of sexuality, that it's always the woman who will be blamed if there's a situation of sexual misconduct. It's always on her. But these teachings went way back. And when I took a close look at these teachings, they were far worse than I ever imagined. And I came to see how teachings of sexuality, how of female subordination, of masculine leadership and power all came together to create the situation that we find ourselves in right now.
There's a few people in the comments and the questions sort of wondering whether it's, you know, whether we're putting too much weight here on the masculinity thing. For instance, here's one who says, if I can find it now, that it's not a case of toxic masculinity, but toxic humanity. You know, isn't it both sexes, if you like, that are at play here, and so on. I mean, and another person asking, you know, how would you describe the masculinity of Jesus? What for you is, you know, I suppose obviously everyone is flawed, everyone is fallen, and so on. Why particularly do you feel that this is a problem of masculinity rather than you know, femininity or any other issue?
Well, full disclosure, my next book is on Christian femininity, so I'll have plenty to say on that too. And I do have a chapter on femininity and Jesus and John Wayne as well. So there's much more to be said. Also, I am a Calvinist, so I'm totally cool with everybody being fallen. You know, sin is not, you know, women don't get a pass. But if you look at American evangelicalism, if you are all familiar, if you spent any time in these spaces, if you've read any of the literature, you're going to know that the way evangelicals talk about sin is highly gendered. The way evangelicals talk about humanity is highly gendered, right? So you've got books on how to be a Christian man, books on how to be a good wife. You've got, you know, it's just, you know, as James Dobson has said, men and women are different in every cell of their bodies. And like I said, by different, it means opposites. So what we see happening then are things like, you know, talk about, you know, humanity, what it means to follow Christ. You know, let's talk fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, you know, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control. These things are all feminized. These virtues are considered feminine. So that's great for the ladies. Courage, boldness, right? Violence when needed. That's what it is to be a Christian man. Now, obviously, like all of these things, there can be a virtue and, you know, certainly courage, boldness. If that's separated from love, joy, peace, right? Then that's where we have the ingredients for these toxic situations. And so in evangelicalism, this stark division of the genders, and then then this emphasis of, you know, the kind of warrior masculinity for men ends up, in fact, transforming their image of Christ himself. Because the question I think you're posing, that, you know, Jesus of the Gospels, as a Christian, as I understand Jesus, what was most radical about the Christian faith is here we have God becoming man, divesting himself of power, offering himself as a sacrifice, right? The suffering servant. And that is the Christ that we are called to follow. And that is hard. We are not wired for that. That is countercultural. It goes against our design. Again, I'm a Calvinist, but that's what we aspire to be. But in this whole discourse of Christian manhood, this warrior masculinity, it's the opposite. And so I think we have to talk about masculinity because it's about Christianity.
I've heard sort of almost the opposite argument, though, and I'll give you my Mark Driscoll story here at this point, Christine, which is that back in the end of 2011 or early 2012, when he was promoting his Real Marriage book, obviously when he was, you know, still in the public spotlight, I did an interview with Mark about the book, but also a sort of profile interview for a fairly large Christian magazine here in the UK. It's sort of the British equivalent of Christianity Today, Premier Christianity magazine. And I obviously asked him some of those questions about his, tone and some of the controversies and the things he says on Twitter and that sort of thing. And I pushed back. I tried to be a good journalist, in terms of getting some questions and answers in there from him. And we ended up talking about women in ministry. And I kind of dropped in at the end that actually my wife is a minister and in ministry. And he kind of took this as a sort of almost, I think he took it as I'd sort of, tried to one up him or something. And he turned the tables on me, and the interview finished with him grilling me about my theological beliefs and this sort of thing. And one of the things he said in the course of that was that he didn't think a woman could lead a church, not just for theological reasons, but because he believed a woman couldn't attract men. And he asked me, how many men go to your church? What kind of men go to your church? And I was sort of, well, men, all kinds of men go to my church. But he obviously felt that, and I've heard this from people, not just Mark Driscoll, this sense that you've got to have men at the front to attract men. If the men come, the women will come with them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of talk from people saying the church is too feminized. It's all love songs to Jesus. It's all, fuchsia and pastels. And it's men don't come because it doesn't appeal to them in that kind of way. Yeah. So I think that has, whether it's Mark Driscoll saying it or not, a lot of people have felt like, oh, there is a problem of femininity in the church. Mm-hmm. We're too feminized and so on. Now, I don't believe that myself because, I think actually it's extraordinary to see the way that God uses, in my opinion, both men and women to draw people. But there is obviously a camp who believes that actually men are best placed to do that. What's your feeling on that, Christine, that particular kind of argument?
Yeah, I would agree with parts of it, certainly. But I would also say that here we're almost working with these essentialist conceptions of masculinity and femininity, that love songs to Jesus and pastels and fuchsia are what we ladies love. Let me tell you, it doesn't do it for me either. Not at all. Right? That's not the Christianity I'm looking for. That's really a product of this, consumer Christianity, that people have made specific choices, evangelicals in particular, to market Christianity to women in this way and to men in that way, right? And so, you had people like Mark Driscoll who are saying men have to lead the church and we have to make it like war, we have to make it militarized and to attract the men, and then the women, it doesn't really matter, they'll come along one way or another. On the other hand, I'm researching Christian femininity right now, and I've seen how in terms of Christian radio, when women were identified as the primary consumer, music was pitched to what they thought women wanted. And there we get all these love songs for Jesus kind of thing, right? And so this is really a product of essentialist ideas of gender that I would, as a feminist scholar, want to deconstruct and situate culturally and religiously, and the product of this consumer Christianity. So I would be a big fan of deconstructing both of those, this masculinized version that distorts Christianity and the quote unquote feminized version that also distorts Christianity, and try to offer something better.
By the way, if anyone's interested in hearing that interview, we're going to put it out again in light of the fact that this Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast has been of such great interest lately. because the interview is nearly 10 years old now. But we're gonna put it out on our classic replay edition of our podcast this coming week. So,
awesome.
Look out for that. If you're an unbelievable listener, that expect that in your podcast. And which leads me to say, actually, we're heading up to just the last 15 minutes of the show. So now is a good time to get your final questions in. And I'm going to continue to read some out as we draw up to the top of the hour. If you want more from Unbelievable, by the way, you can get hold of the podcast. You can get hold of shows, resources and more at our website. The link is with today's program, wherever you're watching, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And you can subscribe to the newsletter there as well. And we've been talking about Kristin Cobez-Dumais' book, Jesus and John Wayne. Just flash the cover for us again, if you would, Kristin, just so people know what to look out for. There's a link to Kristin's website from today's show as well, where you can find more details about the book. Questions here from Stephen over on the Facebook page, Kristin, who says, do you differentiate between different definitions of evangelical? We talked about this a bit at the beginning, but theological versus cultural. Stephen says it seems dangerous not to, lest we conflate individuals with a group they may not belong to. Any thoughts on how this confusion affects our cultural interactions in society at large? And there's another one here as well, which I'll ask as well. And how do you conclude that militancy came before fear, as opposed to the fear was already there and leaders simply tapped into it? So a couple of questions. Yeah. Are we potentially tarring people with the one too broad a brush with the evangelical thing if we don't take into account their actual beliefs and so on?
Yeah. So, you know, I think actual beliefs do matter. I think self-identification matters a lot, too. I just think that beliefs go far beyond a narrow conception of, you know, this rubric of, crucicentrism, biblicism, things like that. I want to scratch beneath the surface. You talk about biblicism. What are we talking about, really? A lot of Christians will claim, hey, I take the Bible seriously, too. Right. So biblicism, what are you talking about? Let's get a little bit more specific. Which Bible passages are key to faith and life in the evangelical community, in the white evangelical community in particular? And how does that differ from, say, Black Protestantism? Because here's another example. If you take that theological rubric, the vast majority of Black Protestants in America check all of those boxes. The vast majority of Black Protestants in America do not identify as evangelicals because it is very clear to them that there is a lot more to being an evangelical than checking those boxes, right? And so that's where I would say self-identification is important and participation in this broader culture that I map out. So that said, I've also written in other places quite a lot about these kind of warring definitions of evangelicalism. I'm not saying that mine is the only legitimate definition, but what I try to do is say, pay attention to who gets to define evangelicalism and then how they're defining it. So the theological rubric is the preferred definition among evangelical scholars who are themselves evangelicals, so evangelical intellectuals, among the intellectual leaders of evangelicalism, because they claim, and for them, they firmly believe it is a theological movement, right? I'm a cultural historian. I'm going to bring a different toolkit here. Now, they can use their rubric and ask their questions and answer some interesting things. And then it's going to come up short to answer other questions. As a cultural historian, I'm bringing this toolkit. It's going to help me answer some questions and it's not going to answer others. And so I'm not saying this is the one. In fact, I don't even call this a definition of evangelicalism. It's a description of who I'm talking about and why I'm talking about these people in this way. I'm not going for a definition whatsoever. There's a second part to your question.
The second question that Stephen also had was the whole issue of militancy and fear and so on as a driving force.
Oh yeah, which comes first?
And militancy or fear, or was it already there and it's just been tapped into?
Yeah, let me say that when I say that in many cases the militancy came first, I was thinking of very specific situations, right? And I want to say that the fear that is generated is real. Right. It is legit. This is even as it's manufactured, as it's stoked. Like I've talked to so many people who are very, very afraid as evangelicals, feeling like, you know, their religious liberties are going to be stripped from them any day. They're going to be coerced into doing things that their conscience won't allow them to do. Where this really came clear to me, again, very specific examples, was in the rhetoric, the Islamophobia that we saw in the wake of 9/11. And what I came across there is I have this whole chapter that's really bizarre about these fake ex-Muslim terrorists that were all the rage on the evangelical speaking circuit. These guys who claimed to be former Muslim terrorists who converted to evangelical Christianity, and they went around to tell evangelicals how dangerous Muslims were and that they were targeting Americans, American Christians, and American evangelicals, especially because they were the most faithful Christians. And these guys were enormously popular, and they were all frauds. Not only were they frauds, but evangelical organizations continued to promote them, champion them long after they well knew that they were frauds. That's a point where I thought, what is going on here? Because the average evangelical was very afraid of the threat of Islam. And they were, because that had been a fear that had been actively manufactured, right? Which doesn't mean there's not, like, we all live in fear. We're all afraid of different things, that like every single instance, fear came second. But in many of these situations, we see that this is a strategy.
You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, here on Premier Christian Radio and via podcast, broadcasting our recent live stream Q&A with Christine Dumay. Final part of the show coming up in just a moment. Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. Don't forget, you can find more from the show at our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to our new blog as well, where we've been putting up some interesting content reflecting on recent editions of The Big Conversation, plus some interesting content as well from a regular contributor, Eric Strandness, over there on the blog as well. Again, that's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And you can find links to it from today's show as well. Coming up next week on the programme, we're going to be meeting Steve Robinson and Victoria Lim. Both are scientists, but when they met, one was a Christian and one was not. Well, they'll be discussing their two-year dialogue that led to Victoria's conversion. And the transcript of their email communication has been turned into a recent book titled Who Is God Really? Two Scientists Discuss Their Faith. That should be a really interesting show on Unbelievable next week. Later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio on The Profile, Joel C. Rosenberg is Sam Hale's guest. Joel is an American-Israeli communication strategist based in Jerusalem. He's also a New York Times best-selling author. His latest book is Enemies and Allies, looking at fast-paced changes in the Middle East and going behind closed doors. So listen out for that on The Profile tonight here on Premier, or indeed on its own Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And if you're able to rate and review this podcast, if that's the way you're listening, that helps other people to discover Unbelievable as well. So do feel free to do that. Also coming up soon, your feedback and news of a new set of Genexis events in Coventry and London this September. Right now, though, final part of our live stream Q&A with Christine Dumay, author of Jesus and John Wayne.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Another interesting question here, just trying to fit in as many as we can with the rest of our time, Christine. Joey asks, many supporters of the masculinity that Christine argues against will point to passages such as Jesus overturning the tables in the temple.
Favorite.
How do you see passages such as that? Does that count as militancy in your mind, Christine?
Yeah, you know, there's a place for anger. There absolutely is. What I'll say is that's the passage, and then the book of Revelation. That's it. And you know, what happens to the Beatitudes? What happens to the greatest commandment, right? What happens to turn the other cheek? These are literally dismissed as, yeah, that doesn't apply right now. No. You know, you cannot teach a boy to become a strong Christian man by telling him to turn the other cheek. No. Right? So it's explicit rejection. So yes, let's talk about the, you know, overturning the tables of the money changers. But what was Jesus actually doing there? He was going against people who were abusing their power, right? And that's where Jesus got angry. And, you know, the book of Revelation, well, we can bring in some theologians to try to make sense of that. But, you know, the sword was coming out of Jesus' mouth, and there's a lot of symbolism there that we can talk about. So let's not abandon that, but let's hold it together with the central teachings of Jesus. Get yourself one of those red letter Bibles, spend a little time in it, and then come back and see how it fits together. So yeah, there's a space for anger, and there may be a place for violence, but there's also a strong history of Christian pacifism, and we need to hold those in tension.
Chow wants to ask, how much of the right-leaning cultural expressions of the church that you decry, Kristin, owe to the fact that the left has simply departed the institutional church? I suppose there's maybe a couple of different ways of interpreting that question, but I guess some people feel like the left is sort of, there isn't a Christian left anymore, therefore it's going to be a Christian right, that's left behind in that sense.
Well, first of all, that framing might be you could argue that perhaps if you're only looking at white Christianity, and even then it'd need to be qualified. Let's keep in mind that we have, diverse expressions of Christianity, even just here in the United States. And so, again, let's look at Black Protestantism. Are you counting them in the right or in the left? Right. That's really going to mess up our categories. And the Black Christian movement has been enormously influential in American culture, society, and politics. Right. So let's place that near the center where it really needs to be. And then look at, progressive Christianity and, how do we make sense of the Christian left? And we can talk evangelical left, always there, always on the margins, right? But, if we look at the rough statistics of 81%, that leaves 19% of white evangelicals who are not in that camp. So we still have, those folks to consider. And then the mainline and, the Christian left, where what we see is other scholars have suggested either that they're completely hopeless, have no influence, or I think a more nuanced understanding is because they don't have this stark differentiation between the religious and the secular, because progressives tend to embrace the secular. Progressive Christians have certainly over the 20th century in American history really shaped the values of just progressivism and the progressive movement. But because you don't have that stark division between sacred and secular, that influence is often obscured. So there are many ways to kind of frame that question. I would say that conservative Christians in America have been much better, more effectively mobilized, and in terms of their own religious institutions, and also very much in terms of a unified political voice.
Let's maybe at least try to squeeze one more in before we wrap things up, Kristin. Michael says, the Christianity Today podcast on Mars Hill describes an epidemic of fatherlessness as one of the causes of Mars Hill's growth. Could a more motherly church leader similarly attract people? Do you see a psychological need for that? Well, first of all, do you think that, and I can't remember exactly how that quote was used in the podcast, but that an epidemic of fatherlessness has been behind, that sort of call to masculinity and so on in some churches?
I really can't speak with authority to that because I'm a historian and I tend to stay in that lane. Psychologists will have a lot to add to this conversation. I'm, as a historian, always a little skeptical of those claims, and I'd want to see some very clear demographic information. And here too, but even these questions like a mothering church versus a masculine church, maybe these categories need to be deconstructed. Maybe we need to think about, for a fatherless child, what kind of community could provide a model? What kind of, diverse models of leadership might nurture that young person? So I guess my response would be I'd want to know a lot more about what they're talking about. What I did value about the podcast, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, was Mike Cosper's willingness to explore all kinds of different ways of understanding this situation. I was on there and I provided my spin, and I have the whole book to describe it, but he just played around with all sorts of different angles. We could look at it this way, we could look at it that way, and I think it's a very rich resource for that purpose.
Final question, this one's from me, Kristin. What's the future then for the US church? Obviously, one could listen to this podcast, read your book, and think, oh, it paints a pretty bleak picture.
Yes, it does.
Has its witness been irreparably marred, you know, in recent years? What are your predictions maybe immediately? And what do you think, what do you think the way forward is as far as you're concerned?
Yes, its witness has been marred, and that's particularly affecting, the younger generation. That's where you see in terms of survey data, a lot of younger evangelicals leaving, a lot of younger folks just not being drawn into the church. And so that is something of concern to many evangelicals and to many Christian leaders. What I see happening right now is, you know, Ed Setzer has used the terminology, an evangelical reckoning, this kind of soul searching of what have we done? And where are we at right now? And I see that. I get letters, several letters every day from evangelicals sharing that, right? And not just saying, you know, what has happened to me. There's a lot of poignant stories, but how have I, in fact, been complicit in this? And that's the right question to ask. So that reckoning runs deep, and it's happening across American evangelicalism right now. What I don't see happening is evangelical institutions changing course. Not much at all. I see evangelical institutions largely doubling down. And in many cases, you'll have like these voices of protest, people like Beth Moore, people like Russell Moore work hard in these spaces, try to change the direction, and then eventually leave, get pushed out, and say enough is enough. I'm going to go work in these other spaces. Not that they've left evangelicalism, but they've left their institutional homes, and that is what I see happening, not just on the national stage, but locally, all over the place. So what that means is these people are leaving. Where are they going? I mean, they're looking for new homes. Some of them are leaving the church. Some of them are just. I get questions every week. Tell me what church to go to. Where can I find a better spiritual home? But then the institutions that they leave are becoming, if anything, more radicalized because those voices of dissent have said enough. And so those are the dynamics that I see right now. What's in store in the next years? I have no idea. No idea. I'm a historian. I can talk about what happened. I don't know what's next. What I do know as a historian is often what's next is something unexpected, something we just didn't see coming at all that completely changes the landscape. But I will say that as a historian, I find this moment fascinating because so much is up for grabs right now.
It's been fascinating talking to you as well, Kristin, about it. Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us for the past hour, for taking lots of different questions, and for the book as well. And just a reminder, you can find out more about it by going to Kristin's website, kristindumez.com. That's D-U-M-E-Z. There is a link from today's show. Also a link to The Unbelievable Show if you want more conversations, not just conversations where I talk to someone one-to-one, but lots of debate and dialogue as well. In fact, we've got some interesting shows coming up debating these sorts of issues in the not-too-distant future. So, but for now, Kristin, thank you very much for being my guest on our live stream Q&A tonight.
Oh, thank you.
And if you'd like to listen again, you can find this on the Unbelievable podcast. You can find us every Friday on the Unbelievable Show with the podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And you can find us here on the video channel as well, on our Facebook page, on our YouTube channel. For now, though, thank you very much for being with us. Do find links both to Kristin and the show from today's program. And we will say goodbye and see you next time. Bye bye. Hope you enjoyed the broadcast of our recent live stream with Kristin. Don't miss future live streams, by the way. You can do that by getting subscribed to the Unbelievable newsletter at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, our show page, or indeed just go to the link with today's show. And your responses are very welcome, of course, via email, via social media. Not everyone will agree with everything that Kristin had to say on the show today. Always welcome your feedback. So you can do that. Email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or get in touch on the social media too, @unbelievablejb for Twitter. facebook.com/unbelievablejb is the Facebook page. You can get in touch with me as well via my Instagram and my TikTok as well, justin.briley for both of those. Let's get into some of your feedback. Just before we get to that, though, Genexis have been promising to tell you about their new events coming to Coventry and London this September. You may remember that the Genexus events took place back in 2019 in Coventry. I was delighted to host one particular evening of that, bringing some brilliant speakers across the Christian and non-Christian spectrum to talk about the big issues in faith, science, philosophy, and so on. Very much the kind of thing we love talking about on Unbelievable. Very well attended events at Coventry Cathedral. Obviously, 2020 plans had to change and there was more of an online format to what Genexus did. But back in person for 2021, this September, in Coventry on the 20th, 21st and 22nd of September, so on consecutive nights, and then in London the following week on the 27th, 28th and 29th of September. If you want to get along, there are some fantastic speakers across the course of this year's Genexus event. Professor Tom McLeish, Professor Paul Davies, Professor John Lennox, Tom Holland, Sharon Dirks, Andy Bannister, Reverend Stephen Forster, and Professor Tom Wright as well, who we all know. So some really fantastic speakers and topics. And each evening, essentially a series of short, engaging talks on specific scientific, philosophical, historical questions, and hopefully to inspire conversation and further exploration on the nature of existence, what it means to be human, and whether there is a creator God. So these will be great to get along to. Genexus.org is the place to go. Genexus, that's Genexis.org. And again, in Coventry, 20th, 21st and 22nd of September, London the following week on the 27th, 28th and 29th of September. And best of all, it's entirely free to attend. So that's genexus.org. Let's go to some of your feedback. You've been getting in touch with the last few weeks of shows. They have been debates on meaning, truth and love, rationality rules and Simon Edwards, William Lane Craig and Joshua Swammerdass on the historical Adam and Eve, and of course that discussion on egalitarian and complementarian views of biblical womanhood as well. So lots of feedback that's come in over the last few weeks. Let's start with the most recent show though. Rationality rules, our atheist guest, and Simon Edwards, our Christian, debating meaning, truth and love. Fabian on Twitter said, great show again, but why all the fuss about libertarian free will? Now, this was something that was debated between Simon and Stephen on the show. Fabian says, if God exists, he decided to create us out of libertarian free will. All else being equal, he did not need to create us. He may then grant us that capacity as well, or he doesn't. And determinism rules. Okay, thank you very much. Dan got in touch. He really appreciated the show. It's lovely to hear from you, Dan, who runs something called Rock Ranch out in the USA, and says, truly admire your work, Justin. That latest Unbelievable episode featuring Simon Edwards and Stephen Woodford ignited once again the reasons why I choose to invest my time and dollars into your podcast and premiere. It was incredible. The deep, thoughtful, imaginative and patient discourse between your guests painted a remarkable picture of civility born from mutual respect for one another. It was beautiful. I'm a Christian, and my faith definitely influences my worldview. I truly tried to engage intellectually with the well-researched and developed dialogue that Stephen presented. He's very articulate and patient in sharing his beliefs, or lack thereof, I guess. As the conversation was drawing to a close, I found myself experiencing a profound sense of sadness for him. He may wonder why I'd have such a silly response. After all, he insisted on multiple occasions that he was truly just fine with the certain end of his time in existence, whenever it occurs, because he's enjoyed himself, some of his conversations with others, and this, the latest version of the naturally selected and evolved world we're living in. I did hear him make a quick reference to skydiving being scary, and I wondered, given the supposed meaningless of it all, why he'd be scared. Anyway, the reason for my sadness came more towards the end of the show, when talking about love, I was struck by his definition of love sounding like robust bio-evolved chemical flares creating impressive neuro-emotional responses in his head, which, by the way, he probably cannot trust given the naturalistic path he's chosen. And I was moved to sadness. It struck me that he may never have the capacity to truly know unconditional love, its transcendent nature, so majestically gifted to us all, not evolved, but always here from the beginning of time, gifted, even divinely grafted into all of us through the Holy Spirit. I know it's true. I see it available, living and reaching out every day through our work with children and families here in Southwest Minnesota. It's not of us, but of him through us. Anyway, you say, I prayed for Stephen following the program and also for Simon and felt his presence on Unbelievable was poised and confident, as well as admirably and genuinely curious. Thank you so much. And thanks for your support of the show as well, Dan. Very interesting to hear your responses to that program between Simon and Stephen last week. A very different response from Phil Stillwell, who's an atheist listener of the show, says, I have one comment on the Simon Edwards episode and one question for your personal feedback, if you've time. Simon Edwards says that Nagel and Huxley, in their most honest moments, claimed that they don't want there to be a God, because if there were a God, I would be accountable to someone other than myself. This doesn't appear to be one of Simon's most honest moments. I found no evidence that either Nagel or Huxley actually make these claims as presented. Would it be too much to ask Christians to accurately represent the position of non-believers? Thank you very much. I knew what Simon was referencing there. There is a quote, and I've used it in my own book, from Nagel in particular, who says, I don't want there to be a God. Now, whether he goes on to explicitly say, because I don't want to be accountable to someone other than myself. But I sense, if you read the full quote, it's sort of implicit in the sense that one of the reasons Nagel doesn't want there to be a God is because for that reason. Now, perhaps that was, you know, slightly Simon extrapolating from the quote itself. But in any case, I appreciate what you're saying. We need to represent people as accurately as we can. But secondly, you go on to say, I have for several years been trying to understand the notion that materialistic evolution requires that we can't trust our brains and cannot discern what is rational if any degree of rationality is only a product of evolution. Allow me to elaborate. Christians themselves do not invoke God when they're assessing the degree of reliability of their minds. Christians do not believe they're born fully rational, and they also believe their own rationality declines as they age. Rationality is demonstrably not a binary have it or don't have it proposition, but rather something they agree is demonstrated by IQ tests or tests administered by doctors who can detect declining cognitive abilities. Why must God be invoked on the question of whether we can trust our cognition? And you say there appear to be several misguided assumptions in this notion C.S. Lewis promoted. A, the degree of rationality is not essentially binary. It intrinsically falls on a gradient. B, that degrees of rationality change over a lifetime. And C, the metrics for rationality are simple tests of a subject at a particular time rather than invoking the alleged reliability of the creator in that subject. Anyway, I'll leave it there for the moment, Phil. Thank you for your questions. I think, I mean, just as you've asked this question to me, what I make of it, I think you're dealing with rationality, yes, as a cognitive ability in this case. But I think when someone like Plantinga or C.S. Lewis or indeed Simon on the show talk about the argument from reason, they're talking about the concept of reason, whether you can even have a concept of reason in a kind of naturalistic world, and whether you can trust that reason on the basis of an evolutionary process, whether you can trust the idea that we have access to that process of reasoning, if you like, with brains that are essentially evolved for survival rather than for truth. Interestingly, Philip Goff, who's another non-Christian but former guest on the show, gets in touch on the same issue, and perhaps some of this is pertinent to your questions to me, Phil. So another Phil here, Philip Goff, says, enjoyed that discussion between Stephen and Simon. Two thoughts, though. First, it's a shame when Christians give Plantinga's evolutionary argument against naturalism that they very often miss the crucial claim that natural selection is only interested in behaviour and not the content of thought. To be fair, it makes it more complicated, but the argument just doesn't really work without that. And you go on to say, secondly, I've come to think that the Lewis-style argument from reason depends on Platonism about practical and theoretical reasons. I think it should go like this. A, Platonism, practical and or theoretical reasons are not part of the causal order. B, determinism, our behaviour is totally determined by prior causes. C, therefore our behaviour is not responsive to practical/theoretical reasons. D, a definition of rationality, someone is rational only if their behaviour is responsive to practical/theoretical reasons. E, therefore we are not rational. Now, of course, many atheists will deny the Platonism premise, but it's still significant, as many philosophers are both Platonists and determinists. I think I might write a paper on this, says Philip, who is an associate professor of philosophy at Durham University. I'm glad it's sparked such interest. Anyway, this discussion that was part of that wider program on free will, determinism, reason, and so on. If you want to hear a really detailed discussion from Unbelievable on the argument from reason, then I do recommend that debate we had back in early 2020 in the archives between Max Baker-Hitcher, Christian philosopher at Oxford, and atheist YouTuber Alex O'Connor, cosmic skeptic. And you finished by saying, Philip, incidentally, I was prompted by this conversation to read Lewis's Miracles for the first time, and it's brilliant. I was put off Lewis by reading Mere Christianity years ago, but this is much better. Not sure it's persuaded me to be a more orthodox Christian, but lots of great stuff in there. Thank you, Philip, for getting in touch. Just one more here on this show. We'll do this from George Pringle out in Sparks, Nevada, who says, hope you're doing well, Justin. Thoroughly enjoyed the episode. I thought both Simon and Stephen were extremely gracious in their exchange. For me, the self-defeating nature of most of Stephen's argument was most evident in the section where, among other things, he made the following statements. I don't think we have access to the truth. You can't know anything is absolutely true. Does that mean we have to throw out naturalism or theism because we can't actually ascertain the truth as a 100% certainty? I don't think that's true. Well, how can you make any assertion at all where truth is elusive and unattainable? Simon rightly pointed out that Stephen has to suppress what is obviously and intuitively true and known to hold his views, says George. Anyway, those were some of the responses that came in to last week's debate between Rationality Rules, aka Stephen Woodford, and Simon Edwards, author of that new book on the sanity of belief. We'll hear more of your thoughts on recent shows as well, including those ones between Bill Craig and Josh Swamidas, and indeed Rachel Green Miller and Beth Allison Barr on biblical womanhood as well in future editions of the programme. That's all we've time for, though, on today's show. So thank you so much for being with us. And I hope you can come back same time next week for more from the show. I'll be joined by Steve Robinson and Victoria Lim. Both are scientists, but when they met, one was a Christian and one was not. They'll be discussing the two-year dialogue that led to Victoria's conversion. And the transcript of their email communications has recently been turned into a book called Who Is God Really? Two Scientists Discuss Their Faith. Join us for that show, same time next week.